Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's another book club day. And this time we're talking about the book titled The Peacekeeper with the author, Brooke Blanchard. She's with us. Brooke writes as B.L. Blanchard. She's a graduate of UC Davis Creating Writing Honors Program. Writing fellow at Boston University School of Law. She's also a lawyer. She's an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, and she's originally from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So as we talk with Brooke about her book, maybe you're wondering about the writing process or the research she did to bring Anishinaabeg language to life on the page. Want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brooke Blanchard, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, for the Larry Mueller Show book club book, we always look for, for one thing, we want to promote books and ones that we're not sure receive enough attention for sure. We also have some criteria about the book, either the author being from Wisconsin or the book taking place at least in part in Wisconsin. And when we saw your book and looked at it and saw the context of it, I thought, oh man, this is going to be great. And it is, it's a great book. I really enjoyed it. There's so many aspects to the book, the Peacemaker. It's a murder mystery. It's also a story about letting go of guilt, I think we could say, maybe without giving too much or giving everything away. For those who haven't read it, give us an overview of your book.
Sure. It's an alternate history, so it's sort of the what if. And it's set in 2020. I wrote the book in 2019, but I guess I knew in some part I would want an alternate version of that year. So it's set in 2020 in an America that was never colonized. And by America, I mean the continent, not the country, but because the US and Canada don't exist. And it's a world where colonization never happened. And so it's an industrialized, modern 21st century Anishinaabe society. And in it, in the village of Bawitagong, which we know in our world is Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, there's a peacekeeper named Chibanashi. Peacekeepers are, I guess, the closest analog is a police officer in a very sleepy small town. 20 years ago, his mother was murdered, his father confessed, and you know, they've kind of limped along ever since in his family. And then 20 years later, his mother's best friend is found murdered as well. And lacking any local leads, he has to go to the big city of Chicago, which we know in our world is Chicago. And in Chicago are two things he never wanted to deal with again. One is his father is incarcerated there. And the other is the woman who broke his heart has since moved there. So he has to go into this brave new world and try to solve a mystery and also repair some things in his own history.
I wondered how the heck you came up with the idea or the inspiration for the Peacekeeper. Not everybody would think of something like this.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, a lot of people think about all the time. I was not one of them. I live in San Diego and I work in downtown San Diego, and the freeway I take takes you through, it's a beautiful drive, takes you through Balboa Park and spits you right out into downtown. So I'm listening to a podcast, I'm just driving, and I get this kind of image pop into my head. It's a high rise building, a skyscraper, and almost like a cathedral stained glass window, there's a dream catcher sort of carved into the side. And I thought, oh, that's very interesting. And if you want a thought experiment that will occupy you for years or even a lifetime. Try to imagine a world without colonization, where it had never happened. There's a million ways you can go with it. I went down rabbit hole after rabbit hole, and you know, the more you think about it, the more possibilities come to you.
Maybe tell us, talk a little more about what the world looks like in the book.
Sure. So it's a world that there was no overseas colonization by Europe ever. And so that's sort of the premise. There's actually a companion book to this that was published last year called The Mother, and it shows what Europe and specifically Britain looks like without the British Empire in the present day. In the world of the Peacekeeper, where we're in the Great Lakes, it's a Great Lakes nation called Minowaki, which means the good land. It's borderless. There are no defined borders anywhere. It's a modern present day. So people have smartphones. There is television. There's high-rise buildings. There are sustainable buildings in both village level as well as the city level. So in Bawi Tagong, there are wigwams, but they are, you know, wigwams as they would be built today. So they are multiple stories. They are heated. You know, they have internal heating, but it's still communal living. In Chicago, the big city, there are vertical forests, which are high-rise buildings that have trees and plants built into them. So you're bringing nature into industry. The way I thought about it is you're incorporating that nature into a major city as opposed to paving over it. And that's not my invention, by the way. They've been proposed or built all over the world. It's a world where there's a different criminal justice system. That's another big part of it. It's not a punitive system as we have in our world. Rather than focusing on punishing the defendant, punishing the accused, you're focusing more on making the victim whole. And if you shift the focus of the criminal justice system, what does that look like? So those, I think, are probably the big things. But
yeah, it's really interesting. You know, when I looked at your book first, by the way, the cover is great.
Fantastic.
The person who put the cover together did a wonderful, wonderful job. But when I opened the book, the first thing I saw was this map. And
yes.
I thought, oh, good, a map. And I'm looking at the map, and I'm, what the heck? And I finally turned the map about upside down to sort of orient myself better, because it looked like, wait, what? Where is this place? And then I said, oh, okay. When I turned it upside down, I sort of oriented it. Was there some reason for the orientation that way?
Sure. So for those who might not be familiar, the first page is a map, and it is North America kind of flipped on its side. So instead of north being pointed toward the top, it's east. And the reason for that is actually an Anishinaabe tradition, and many North American tribes, the direction that you orient toward is not north, but rather east, the direction of the rising sun. And I am a huge map nerd. We could spend the whole hour just nerding out over maps, and I will be so happy. Fun fact is that maps being oriented toward the north is actually more a matter of, you know, custom as opposed to any real reason. You can orient them in any direction. Sometimes you'll see, you know, in the southern hemisphere or in Australia, they'll show what looks like the earth turned upside down. That would be valid. So that's one reason why. And also it's a little hint that the perspective is literally different in this book. It's not the America that everyone lives in now. It's the world that could have been, but it's literally and figuratively a new view of it.
Yeah, I actually went back to that map more than once when I was reading, just to sort of reorient my, our main protagonist, Chibanashi, traveled around a little bit. But I thought it was really cool. I was glad you had it in there. And I'm glad to hear what your reasoning was for it. you know, is this genre of speculative fiction or alternative history, what do you find most interesting about that approach?
I think I like that there's a definite starting point. You pick a moment in history and you think, well, what else could have happened? And really commonly you'll see, you know, what if World War II had ended differently? What if the Nazis had won? Or you'd see, what if the Civil War had ended differently? You know, what if the South had won? Or, you know, those I think come up a lot, but there are so many ways it could have gone. And I think it forces us to think about decisions that were made and sort of the alternate timelines that could have existed. There's a really great alternate history novel by Michael Chabon. It's called The Yiddish Policeman's Union. And that was one that I read before writing this one because I loved the idea of it. And it took a real moment in history, which was a proposed Jewish settlement in Sitka, Alaska, that I believe it failed by only one vote in the Senate. The idea was to create sort of a haven for Jewish refugees, and it failed, and so it wasn't created. But it looks in the present day, the book was written, I think, about 20 years ago, what it would look like had there been a Jewish settlement in Alaska starting in the early 40s, and how the culture would have evolved and how history would have been different. I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, because I think it tells us how small changes could really lead to wildly different outcomes, and some of them for the better, some for the worse. I like to think the Peacekeeper is not a bad outcome that could have happened, but there are others where, you know, it would make you grateful that things did turn out the way that it did.
Chibonacci, and he works as a peacekeeper. Maybe you could talk a bit more about what his work was. How's it different maybe from maybe being a detective?
Well, he's a peacekeeper in a very small village where there really isn't much crime. There isn't a whole lot for him to do. At one point in the book, someone points out really his job is kind of recovering lost property, because that's the biggest thing that tends to happen here. In this, you know, this is a society that's built with Anishinaabe worldviews. Community is paramount, and everyone is sort of expected to keep an eye on each other as well as support each other. And so if there is some sort of aberration, if there is a crime committed, you haven't just hurt the victim, you haven't just hurt yourself, you've hurt the community as a whole. And that different sense of responsibility, at least in this book, means that there is less crime, because you are thinking about yourself in the context of a larger whole, not just you as the individual. So as a result, he doesn't do a whole lot. There isn't a lot for him to do. And he's not the best at his job as a consequence.
Wasn't classically trained, for sure.
No. And in fact, someone pointed that out to me, like, he's not very good at his job. And I said, I know, he's not. Because he just doesn't have that much hands-on experience. And that actually isn't, you know, too uncommon either. I listened to a podcast several years back. It's called In the Dark, and it was very popular. It was about an unsolved missing persons case in the 80s in, I think, Minnesota, and how it there was no reason for it to take 30 years to be solved, and basic steps in policing had been missed by this very small town. And had they taken basic steps like canvassing the neighborhood and interviewing people, they probably would have found this person much more quickly. And how that's not limited to that town, it's in big cities, small towns, everywhere. So I wanted to show this is one where, you know, people are making errors, and it is, and they are missing things and getting better at their job. So I think that's probably his, you know, he's, for what he does most of the time, he's not bad at it, but give him a bigger crime to solve. He meets another peacekeeper who's like, man, you guys don't know what you're doing, and we're going to help you because we know better than you. And imagine you're in a new place. It's a place you don't want to be. And you've met someone who's not only just personally very annoying to you, he's also better at your job than you are. Fortunately, I really went through a lot.
Brooke Blanchard. our guest today. Her book is titled The Peacekeeper. And you can join in. Questions, thoughts, comments, the number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about the book today titled The Peacekeeper, and Brooke Blanchard, she writes as B.L. Blanchard, our guest today to talk about it, enjoying it. Questions for her, again, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. You're a lawyer, too, and I'm at your knowledge of the current justice system certainly probably helped in many ways. But the mediation scenes in the book were really intriguing to me. And I guess I didn't know very much about mediation and how it works. Describe it in the book, and is this how we do it today?
So mediation is a form of, in the real world, it's what we call a form of alternative dispute resolution. So instead of going to court, everyone gets, you often hire like a retired judge or an experienced attorney who will come in and try to help the parties reach a settlement. And that's how most civil cases, lawsuits get resolved, is through some sort of informal settlement, and a lot of times with the help of a mediator. And the mediator will help you figure out, you know, okay, can you kind of help the parties reach an agreement? In the book, it's used, now we use that for civil cases. In criminal cases, we use the plea bargaining system often, where you will kind of reach a deal to plead guilty, maybe to a lesser offense or for a reduced sentence or things like that. In the book, that is what we have instead of the trial and jury system. And so this is how, based on Navajo peacemaker courts, which are used by the Navajo Nation. I also look to the Japanese criminal justice system for some of this as well. And what it is instead of a, you know, judge, jury, you know, you've got the defendant on trial, did they do whatever thing they're being accused of? And that is the focus, is the defendant guilty or not guilty? And we're going to sit in judgment of that person. In a peacemaker court and in the system in the Peacekeeper, everyone's focusing on the victim. What would make the victim whole? And it's a concept in the law called restitution. Again, this is a civil law concept, but it can also be used in criminal law. How have you been wronged, and what would help make you whole? So that's the focus of the criminal justice system in the Peacekeeper, is we have a victim and here's how they've been wronged. And it could be anything from a small thing all the way up to murder. How do we make this person whole from what's happened? What could the accused do? And it's premised on them accepting responsibility for it. What can they do to help resolve this and make it whole? And so that's the focus there. So it's not on how do we punish, it's how do we repair? And that's and so in the book, Chibanashi's father is incarcerated, and that is a punishment of last resort. Most people aren't incarcerated. It's considered the worst of the worst thing that could happen. And so it's called like a decarceral society. It's one where we don't throw people in jail. We try to make people better.
Yeah, that was really, really fascinating to me to read those scenes. Chibanashi, he struggles a lot with guilt and grief and finding his way a bit throughout the novel. In some ways, I think the book is a story about a man finding himself.
Yeah, it's him finding himself when he was 17. His mother is brutally murdered, and murder just does not happen where he lives. And his father immediately confesses to it. So he's lost both and is imprisoned. He's lost both parents as a result. And he has to take care of his sister, Ashwiye, for, you know, basically the rest of his life. And she has significant trauma, as does he. So these are two very broken people who isolated themselves from the rest of the community. They haven't really dealt with their trauma. And so it's figuring out how to overcome that years and years later, because I'm of the belief it's never too late to try to do that. But you do it when you're ready. And it took them a long time to get there.
Do you have a reading? Is there a piece in the book that you read that might capture maybe part of that, or or just one that you like to read during these times when you're talking to people about your book?
Yes, there is. This is a scene toward the beginning of the work. It takes place in a medicine lodge with Wakui, the medicine woman, who is the elder in the village, who she's there for religious, spiritual reasons, but she's also in for Chibanashi. She's really just sort of there as almost a therapist for him. And he's come to her to talk about some dreams he's had, you know, his trauma. The anniversary of his mother's death is coming up. That's always a difficult time for him. And she's trying to help him, you know, try to start to heal. And so they're sitting together and she's telling him, "You must dream. Without dreams, his spirit would," she said, "without dreams, his spirit would be rooted to the physical world. Spirits needed to be free to communicate between this world and the next, and dreams were the conduit." She stood and went to the shelves behind her. She dangled a branch wrapped in a circle with a deer sinew threaded around it like a spider web. Three feathers dangled from the bottom. "But if you do need assistance," Chibanashi swatted the dream catcher away. "I'm not a child," he sighed. "Besides, I already have one. It does nothing." "So you agree," Wakui said, "that it's better to face the dreams than to block them." "Please," he croaked out. "If you try to keep it out, it will only appear to you more forcefully than before. You must confront it. Learn to let it not hold you hostage." She took a few padded footsteps toward him and knelt down. "Remember the cycle of life." Wakui raised her hand up and pointed a finger straight between his eyes. "Creation." She drew her hand down in a half circle, stopped at the bottom. "Destruction." She drew the other half of the circle and stopped her finger between his eyes again. "Recreation." She drew the circle again, this time without pause. "Your mind and heart want to be here," she said, pointing to the top of the invisible circle. She dropped her finger to the bottom. "But it's stuck here. It wants to rise, but it cannot because your guilt weighs you down. To get from here," she pointed to the bottom, "to here," she drew her finger to the top, "is the journey of life. It's a circle that repeats over and over. Destruction is meant to be recovered from. Recreation of something more beautiful and stronger than what existed before awaits. But you have to be willing to make that climb."
Oh, that's a great part, and tells us a lot. It's kind of a central little statement in the book early on.
Yeah, it sort of lays out the map for what the journey he's about to go on. He's been through trauma. There's been destruction. He's got to rebuild. You can't go back to where you were before, but you have to rebuild, hopefully something better.
Dan in Superior, let's go to you. Dan, thank you for calling.
Hi, it's actually Jan. Thank you so much. I was in the UP for 7 years, another UPer. I worked in Brimley as a student volunteer for some time. My question is how your time in the Upper Peninsula, if you're close to Brimley, for example, how that affected where you are today. In the late 60s, we had an extremely small number of people from the reservation around Brimley, for example, going to college. Upward Bound was a program that may have affected you. Any ways that your life in the Upper Peninsula has affected where you got today? It's so wonderful to hear success stories in today's world.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Brooke, comment?
Sure. We moved out of the UP to Northern California when I was still a kid. And for a variety of reasons, my father became estranged from his family. So I didn't reconnect with them until I was almost 20 years old. But when I did, I started going back regularly. Most of my family still lives in Gould City, which is on the Lake Michigan side. It's a very, very small town. I love it. I think it's the most beautiful place on earth. Especially in the summer. I've lived in California too long to go back in the winter. but it's wonderful. As to how it's affected, I mean, I have wonderful family who I'm so grateful to be connected with. I wish I could go back to the UP more often. But every time I'm there, I really feel like I'm home. And I remember the first time going back since my childhood. I was, 19, almost 20, and driving. I drove up from Chicago through actually Wisconsin all the way up. And just the closer I got to Menominee, which is your first stop in the UP on that drive, the more it really, really felt like home. I remember driving through Peshtigo and just the topography starts to change and I just felt pulled back there. So it's wonderful. I mean, both of my parents are from the UP, my father from Gould City, my mother's from Marquette. My maternal grandmother is from Hooton, and I guess the best way I can describe it is it's a singular place on earth and one that I kind of feel like I lost a lot by not spending more of my childhood there between the time we moved away and the time I came back and started reconnecting with my family. But I'm so grateful for it, and it allowed me to reconnect with my Chippewa culture. I had primarily been in touch with my mother's side of the family for a long time, and they're the non-Chippewa side. So it's just a wonderful place if you haven't been.
Dan, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. Chibanashi is the primary caretaker for his sister, Ashwia. It's a role that takes a big toll on his health. Why is he so devoted to her?
He feels like he failed. When I was writing him, I tried, for every character, I always try to figure out I called it their prime directive. What is their thing that drives them throughout? And in his case, it's protect his sister, because when his mother was murdered, he was out drinking with his buddies. He was passed out. He missed everything. And he has always felt that if he hadn't been so irresponsible, he might have been able to stop it. And his sister witnessed it and has never been the same since. So his drive is always to protect her. Every decision he makes is governed by that. And it all goes back to that night. So he wants desperately to undo it, which obviously he can't. He can't go back in time. So he's tried to make up for it ever since and let his devotion to her be the primary driver of his life. And he's given up a lot for it. The love of his life wanted to move away to the big city. Her prime directive is she's very ambitious. She said, let's go to Chautauqua. I'm going to be an advocate, which is a lawyer in that universe. And he's like, I can't leave my sister. And at one point he describes it as, he loved Dawkinson, his love, but he loved his sister more. And that's why he stayed there his whole life, because he wanted to be with her and protect her.
Yeah, interesting. Sharon in Green Bay has something. Let's go there. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Larry and Brooke. I'm a librarian. I'm really enjoying your book talk today. While I haven't read this particular book, it's on my to-read list, but my question for Brooke is, we've definitely over the years seen more Indigenous authors coming to the forefront. Have you found it challenging in your writing journey to get publishers to take notice?
I don't think it was any more so than anyone else who's trying to get published. It's hard. It's hard to get it. It's hard to finish a book. It's hard to get an agent. It's hard for that agent to sell your book to a publisher, and it's hard to get a readership. I'm so thrilled that there are so many Indigenous authors who are getting so much attention, and really, really great books coming out. Some of my favorites are Stephen Graham Jones, in particular, his horror novel, The Only Good Indians, David Heska Wambly Wyden's Winter Counts, that's a contemporary murder mystery. Erica Wirth has a horror novel called White Horse that I really love. Rebecca Roanhorse, she writes fantasy. Tommy Orange has a literary fiction novel called They're There. There's a lot of great Indigenous horror, Indigenous speculative fiction. We're really in a wonderful time where so many authors can get that kind of exposure, and I feel very fortunate to be one of them.
Yeah, and you it probably took you a while to get this whole process. I mean, getting a book published, finding as you say, finding even an agent, I imagine the right agent is a task.
It is. I wrote the book while I was on maternity leave, and because I thought I have two children now. I'm never going to have free time again in my life. It's now or never when I'm only taking care of a newborn and a 4-year-old. So, you know, writing it is a challenge, finishing it is a challenge. The research took a really long time, just trying to create the world and, you know, figuring a lot of things out. And then getting an agent is tough. It's called the querying process. You have to be prepared for a lot of rejection. I'm fortunate that I have a wonderful literary agent and we found a great publisher in 47 North. But yeah, it's any professional writing is, I've always described it as you're swimming through a sea of rejection and a sea of no's to get to those small nuggets of yes here and there, but it's worth it. And I love writing just for its own sake. Even if I weren't published, I would still do it.
So. Oh, that's great. The names in the, I tell you, there are a fair number of kind of, well, there's one, you know, really main character, Chibonacci, but there are a lot of characters in the book and the names. How did you choose the names for the characters? And I think each person's name means something, right?
Each person's name does mean something. I tried not to tie it too close to personalities necessarily. I was mindful that these Anishinaabe names might be difficult for a lot of readers. Just to list through a few of them, our main character is Chibonacci, his sister's Ashuye, his ex-girlfriend is Dakison, the other peacekeeper is Takumwa. Confession, he's my favorite character in the whole book. There's Pijaki, who's the lead peacekeeper. Ishkode was his father. Meokwani is his mother's best friend. Nibin, his mother. I'm well aware that these are probably not names most readers are going to be familiar with. So I tried to find, and some Anishinaabe names are really, really, really long. So I tried to use names that are relatively short. That would be, I think, easier to learn to pronounce. And I also made sure that each character's name starts with a different letter of the alphabet so that if the name is a little difficult to pronounce, you could see, okay, it's the C character, the T, the D, the A, and follow them that way. I've read a lot of books where even if there's like a Dave and a Dan and you have to keep them straight, I've completely confused them before. My sister, you know, said when she was reading Lord of the Rings, Arwen and Eowyn, she was like, I can't. She, until the movie came out, she got them very confused. So that was my attempt to make it as accessible as possible. But at the same time, you know, I'm not going to name them, you know, Steve or anything like that. So that just wouldn't be true to the world. So, but I also think, you know, we learn to pronounce a lot of complicated names that are not, you know, necessarily familiar to an English speaking world. So if you can master things like Tchaikovsky or, you know, Dostoevsky, you can probably handle some Anishinaabe ones.
Oh, they were, I like the names. I mean, it took a while just to kind of, as I read along to, you know, and I'm paying pretty close attention because I know we're going to talk. but Takumwa, you know, I agree with you. I thought you can get another book out of Takumwa. I just liked his personality and his smarts and, I don't know, just the way he approached life.
He's basically if a golden retriever's personality was grafted onto a human. Everyone is his new best friend. He does not know when to shut up. He's a talker, and Chibonacci's very reserved. He's almost in a defensive crouch and has been for most of his life. So he got someone who's like, hey, best friend, this is my new best friend, and he won't stop talking. And again, he's better at his job than Chibonacci is at his. That is kind of his own personal nightmare. But yeah, I loved him. I've had in the back of my mind I would love to do Takumwa's tragic backstory, but I don't have anything fleshed out. I kind of like the mystery of it more. But yeah, he was a lot of fun to write. I always describe it as I was writing the book, and then he shows up. You know, he swings open the door midway through a sentence and he didn't stop talking. And I just completely fell in love with him.
Yeah, I liked him a lot. Let's talk about the place names for a minute, too, and the meetings on those place names. I wondered if Chicago, which is what we know as Chicago, I wondered if that was, as I was reading, I wonder if that was a native word for that area that got somehow changed along the way to Chicago.
From what I've been able to tell, yes, it's a Miami word, and it means, you know, the place where the onions grow, at least in the research I did. There are other words for it. There is an Anishinaabe name for it, and it's escaping me at the moment. But there are other native words, but that's the one that I saw come up most often, and I thought it sounded, I decided to use that for a couple reasons. One, I thought it was similar enough to Chicago that it would help orient readers as to where we are. But also, I wanted to show that this was not utopia. And
yes,
pre-Columbian, there were lots of disputes and wars between different nations. And I wanted to show that the Anishinaabe had sort of subsumed some other cultures around it as the dominant cultural force. And Tecumseh is actually a Miami character, and he calls out Chibonacci saying, "This is our word. You don't call, you know, Chicagua is a Miami word, and our language doesn't get spoken anymore, and our culture is being erased." And Chibonacci kind of harumphs a little bit, you know, and gets kind of his back against the wall, feeling attacked about it. But I did want to bring that in there, because if it's a perfect world, that's boring, number one. And number two, it just wouldn't be true to history. So I wanted to include that for a couple of different reasons, but it was important to me that it be a non-Anishinaabe name for it, because I wanted to show sort of that discord and that history.
Brooke Blanchard, our guest today. She is the author of our book club selection, which is titled The Peacekeeper. Join in with your questions, comments, or I hope you will. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with my guest, author B.L. Blanchard. Brooke Blanchard is the author of The Peacekeeper, and really enjoying talking with her about this, about her book. Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned a little bit, Brooke, about Chicagua itself. And you know, Chibonacci sees people, gets a little bit surprised at what a big city like Chicagua is like.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's people on this living on the streets and so forth.
Yeah, again, this isn't utopia. And where he comes from, it's a small town. Everyone takes care of each other. The idea of someone sleeping on the streets or needing to beg is just completely foreign to him, because this is not a capitalist society. It's not a communist society. It's different from the world we're in, but it's one where, generally speaking, if you have extra, you share it, and if you need, you receive. And he gets to this big city, and he realizes that this foundational core value of his is not being followed. It's one of the first things he sees, and he's horrified. And Tecumseh was like, "Well, you know, it's nothing's perfect," but he's horrified, and he sees that, you know, there's hypocrisy in a lot of different ways throughout. There's a character who is an economics professor, and he's lecturing on, you know, how ideal this economic system is. But, you know, at the same time, he lives in much greater luxury than most people. He's all but disowned his own son. So he's not living up to the values that he was just a few minutes earlier espousing as being this wonderful foundation. And so, yeah, people are dishonest in that society, as they are in any society. I wanted to try to populate this real world with real people, and that meant none of them could be perfect.
You know, There are, just thinking about culture a little bit, there are some customs and stories I think a reader familiar with Anishinaabe culture would recognize. That, and the story begins during Manoman, or Manuman is, how is that pronounced? Is it Manoman?
Manoman.
Yeah, Manoman. Maybe talk about the significance of Manoman for both the characters in your book and people today.
So Manoman is the only grain that's native to the Great Lakes region, and it's a staple food for the Anishinaabe people. And it's dancing the rice and harvesting it, and we call it dancing it to get the grain from the husk. You actually put it, you dig a little hole in the ground, you put a covering on top of the hole, you pour the rice in there, you stand on it, you hold on to two logs, and you dance it. I've never done it, but I've got, my dad does it every year. And I wanted to include that. I also wanted there to be a major holiday, but I also wanted to be able to put my own spin on it. So I thought I want a tradition that is important, but also, and is still celebrated today, but I wanted to show it being a bigger, a different looking event. Because again, this is a world where, you know, our culture was never trampled the way that it was in reality. So that's, you know, I want it to be one, the big holiday that everyone travels for and all the families reunite for. And it's just a fun, happy event that will end in tragedy by the next morning.
Yeah. And it's his place is a tourist place. Oh, by the way, I have every week I buy a loaf of bread, which is wild rice and cranberry bread. And it is the most delicious bread you are ever going to eat. I love that bread. But that took me off my train of thought here for a minute. Another character, thinking culture again here, another character goes to great lengths to retrieve a beaded bag. And it means a lot to him. Traditionally, what are these bags called and why are they important?
So the bags are important because historically they were made by women for men. And they are sort of like a crossbody satchel with very intricate designs on them. And what I wanted to show was that it was really a way of showing a relationship between a son and his mother who had been estranged for a very, very long time and had never reconciled. And so using that bag as sort of, okay, they haven't been able to communicate. Their relationship has been, I don't want to spoil too much, but their relationship has not been good and they've barely been in touch, but he's going to go to great lengths to get this bag because otherwise, you know, that's all he has left to her. And I wanted one that, because I don't think in, you know, modern American society, we think of men carrying around very ornate beaded crossbody bags. So I wanted something that might look a little different, but also have a tremendous amount of significance to that person.
And there's also mention of the creation, the creature called Wendigo.
Yes.
What is that, and what does it represent in the story?
So it's a large cannibalistic wolf-like creature with antlers is how it's usually depicted. There's a Stephen King novel where there's one, I think it was Pet Sematary. And physically that's what it is. And it's the nightmare of stories. In Anishinaabe culture, it's more symbolic of greed and hatred and failing to contribute to your community and also just being very, hurting others. And so here we talk, in this book, it talks about, okay, we're gonna tell the little four-year-old child the scary story about it, but among adults, it's more of a symbolism of, you know, how someone could really become hurtful to others and kind of become soulless as well.
I wanted also to go back to the architecture that you talk about in the book, which I think is different in so many respects from our reality. These living skyscrapers and vertical forests. Describe that for our listeners.
So the picture, you know, your standard high-rise building, maybe it has a lot of balconies on it, maybe it's a large apartment building. You know, where I live in Southern California, high-rise buildings all have balconies because the weather's nice and we like being outside. But instead of it just being this concrete and glass and steel slab, it has large patios on which you have trees and bushes and flowers. You kind of take in the forest and all sorts of plant life, and you're incorporating that into the structure set. Instead of having this, you know, large industrial structure, you are incorporating the world into it. It's a form of sustainable architecture. It's one that allows, especially bird and insect life to thrive in an urban environment. And it's just one that I thought, if you were to have a modern indigenous society, that's how it would have been built, so that it's, you know, again, more sustainable. You're not paving things over, you're making it more alive and more incorporating the natural world into it. And I looked through, there's places in China and in the Middle East and South America that have really done this, and hopefully we'll see it more in America.
Yeah, I went online and looked, I just typed in sustainable buildings or something like that, and there were some photos of just absolutely fantastic. Of course, I did this after reading your book, and I wonder if there are places like this. You do such a nice job of describing that place or those places in your book. It was really fascinating to me, so I went ahead and looked, and they are fantastic. So you had to do a broad range of research for this book.
It was a lot of research. Yeah, a lot of the architecture. I actually talked to a friend of mine, her husband's architect. I was asking him questions about it, about, you know, pre-Columbian Anishinaabe culture. I talked to the cultural department of my tribe, who connected me with some First Nations speakers. So to get the, you know, modern Ojibwa has a lot of French and English words in it. We tried to recreate the pre-Columbian Ojibwa as closely as we could. So I'm very grateful to them for taking the time to assist with that. Also just creating a new criminal justice system and transportation, what would a village look like in the present day? And also just the time frame. I started by thinking, okay, starting from 1491 going forward, how does the world look different? And then, you know, you're thinking, okay, if there was no New World colonization, was there an African slave trade? And if there's not, you know, does that mean that the colonial powers were looking elsewhere, or did they just not do it? What does Asia look like? What does, you know, the rest of, you know, how cohesive are the tribes amongst themselves? You see that there's some tension between Chibonacci, who's Anishinaabe, and a Lakota person he sees on the train. There's some existing prejudice there. Would you have gas-powered vehicles? Just, you know, you can go on and on for a long time. I really encourage people to do so. There's a lot of different ways you can go. I hadn't seen a lot of books that did this, but I hope to see more going forward.
Yeah, it was a wonderful read, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy of The Mother, the book you wrote after, which, as you said earlier, is set in the UK. But in the meantime, I've enjoyed very much The Peacekeeper, and I thank you so much for taking an hour with us. It's most much appreciated. It's a great book, and thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest today, Brooke Blanchard. She writes under B.L. Blanchard, and the book is titled The Peacekeeper. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, I encourage you to take a look. And it did inspire our next segment of our program coming up. I'm Larry Mealer for WPR News. Thanks for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some problems faced by cities. Flooding, heat islands, those are just two problems that cities face and related to climate change. And we're going to be talking about some solutions for dealing with those changes with our guest today. Galen Williams is an associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. He's also a professional landscape architect. He's a licensed arborist, a LEED accredited professional. He has a PhD in urban forestry and over 15 years of practice working on climate adaptation and hazard mitigation projects, primarily in southern cities. We're glad to have him here in the north in Wisconsin. I'm wondering, is your city maybe having more problems with flooding? Is it investing in projects to combat the effects of severe weather? What would you like to know about urban design? All things we can talk about for sure. And you can join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Galen Williams, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, an interesting time to be working in urban planning, I would think, in landscaping and architecture. These are all interesting areas, and certainly it's an interesting time for that. What got you started in this field?
Yeah, I was in the right place at the right time. So, go back 20 years living in New Orleans. My grandmother was a biology teacher at the university level. So anytime I'd go visit with her, she'd have us in the backyard looking at plants, identifying things, hacking back things that were overgrown, identifying invasives. And it kind of put in my ear, I actually like doing this kind of stuff. Always had a knack for art and design. So when I went to college, LSU in Louisiana had a really good program for landscape architecture and just hit the ground running, and the rest is history.
Oh, man. So and talk a bit about where you've worked before coming here.
Yeah, so studied in Louisiana, wound up moving to Georgia, right at the base of the Piedmont, so really good forest area. Worked for a firm in campus design, which was at the time really big on green design, kind of the birthplace of LEED, campuses wanting to market to their students sustainable spaces, sustainable campuses, sustainable buildings. So really got a knack for what that actually meant in the landscape architecture side. Worked there, wound up going to Georgia Tech in Atlanta, studying urban design, really had a knack for designing spaces for people in public. And then during this time, Hurricane Katrina hit the city of New Orleans, where I'm from. So I was going back and forth, helping my parents and family just kind of recover. And that led to me wound up moving back to New Orleans and working for an old professor of mine who started a firm there, and worked there for about a decade, which during that time licensed, became an arborist for several different reasons. Just had a really good affinity for trees, especially living in Atlanta where a lot of trees grow. It's a city in the forest. And that got an invitation to join a PhD program down in Louisiana, which led me to getting my PhD. Then did a little bit of time in Houston, working in Texas, but eventually found my way to Madison.
Yeah, it's a great story. As we look at these cities, our cities now in Wisconsin and elsewhere, what are the main problems you see facing cities because of climate change?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the cornerstones of my research, the idea of climate adaptation and climate mitigation, and what does it actually mean in the realm of site design, landscape performance, and urban forestry. They're two distinct different things. Adapting to climate change will happen. How do we adapt? How do we prepare ourselves for it? And climate change, climate mitigation, how do we start reversing or stifling or suppressing the exponential threat of climate change? Through urban forestry, how do we look at that? And through landscape planning, site planning, how do we start managing water where it falls? So as rain comes down, instead of pumping it across towns or collecting in large reservoirs or in pipes that are usually undersized or have been undersized because storms are becoming more and more consistent and more extreme, how do we start using our landscape to that the water can gather in places that we wanted to recycle into or recirculate into the groundwater plane, or give the city municipal system, the aging municipal system, time to recuperate or manage that water. And then also with urban forestry, as we're getting warmer, we just had an 88 degree day, which is rare for Madison, or at least it used to be, it's coming more common. How do we enjoy Madison the same way? How do we continue to walk down streets? We all realize when there's streets lined with trees, and the ones that aren't. And we always dread, okay, now we're going to have to like hold our breath and try to get through this little section of neighborhood that doesn't have trees. How do we start understanding that trees are required for urban living now, and that they are just as important, in my perspective, as electricity and other quality of life or sustainable life utilities?
So what parts of the country are most likely to have problems with flooding, let's say?
So at this point, I can say all of it. We all have our different issues. We saw it first, I guess, in the South, in Louisiana, South Texas, can date back to large-scale urban flooding issues. But even here, I was walking up East Wash, and they said, oh, I'm glad you waited 10 minutes because it was a big puddle that blocked the entrance to the grocery store. Those little things add up, those count. Those are all interrupting our quality of life. We should be able to enter the grocery store and not have the water back up. Where does that water go? How do we manage it in our landscapes?
Galen Williams, our guest today, as we talk with him about dealing with our cities and during this time of climate change and using perhaps trees to help cities deal with climate change. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. You use the concept of blue-green infrastructure in your work. Tell us what that is.
So it's getting back to landscape performance. We can talk architecture, and we know that if we are dealing with a house renovation or a new building construction, the architect will say, we need this window, this $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 window in order to have enough insulation that we will save X, Y, and Z on energy costs. How do we speak to landscape design to the same way? We need this many trees. We need trees of this species. We need this much impermeable pavement. We aren't really having that kind of conversation, but that's what blue-green infrastructure is. It's the infrastructure that you're putting into the landscape to help sustain or mitigate or adapt to the climate change.
Why aren't we having this discussion more often?
So we are. I think we all have our tree advocacy groups looking to plant more and more trees. I think at the time we are now, we need to be more sophisticated in our conversations. So when we say an architectural dialogue, this window, we can model what that actually looks like and what those savings are. We don't really know if we plant 10 trees, how much beneficial that is than planting 100 trees, or as the governor just said, we're going to plant 100 million trees by 2030. What is the actual impact of that investment? And where do those trees need to go in order to actually help urban or rural or Wisconsin in general? Are we reforesting areas, or are we actually making sure that everyone walks out of their door and has trees lining their sidewalks so they can walk to the grocery store, or they can walk in the park and not overheat, or kids can play outside and get rid of some of that extra energy, or things like that?
Laura in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Laura.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering a way to make trees resilient in our neighborhood. So we recently had some storms. I live in Madison, and like, there was a tree that took down the corner of my neighbor's house. Two trees actually fell down in my backyard yesterday, like big trees, at least 30 feet tall. And we have an arborist come treat some of the bigger trees around our house, but how can we take care of trees so that they don't become a hazard? Because now I'm kind of low-key scared of trees, even though I think they're gorgeous.
You're not the only one there, Laura. I think there are a lot of people who may feel that way.
I agree. And I think it's just understanding what a tree actually is and how it lives. I believe, and a lot of my colleagues would say, the best way to ensure a long-lived, healthy tree that's not going to fall on your house would be to ensure during the first 20 years of its life that you're pruning to have great structural form. We do something to trees when we plant them in urban environments that is not natural. Trees naturally grow in forests. They grow, you can go to the forest and look, they're very linear, they're very vertical. They're growing for sunlight and they are competing against all of the trees around them. When you take the same tree and put it in an urban setting where there might be some buildings, but in general, there's a lot of sunlight, a lot of resources, less competition, they kind of grow to become this lollipop shape that we love in our urban settings, but may not be as ideal as we are facing more wind, more severe storms, more tornado warnings, and more heavy rain. So I think as we continue to design cities and design streets and include trees, we need to start rethinking how we put them in the landscape. Should we be putting them in groups and clusters so that we're breaking apart the wind instead of capturing it all in one in one tree? Should we be investing really early on the tree to ensure that it's got that central leader and that really good structure and great roots instead of waiting till there's a problem and then trying to save a tree that's falling apart? Should we start understanding tree succession and taking out trees but then replacing them on a sustainable way? When we look at utilities, I always compare urban forestry to urban utilities. Every single power pole that's put in our landscape on the streetscape has a shelf life. We are saying we are going to put this in here for 80 years, 50 years, and we are going to start budgeting to replace that pole. Could we think of trees at the same way? This tree is going in. We expect it to live 80 years, 40 years. It depends on the species. Do we plan to then replace it because it is a street tree and that we know we can cycle through some of the benefits if we are sustainably harvesting and replacing trees and renewing those those benefits?
And then on the other hand, you'll find people, well, you can't cut that tree down.
I'm an arborist. I've gone through all the training. If it's a liability, if it's at risk of falling on someone, if the tree is ailing, we do recommend human life is more important. So we would say let's recommend a sustainable way to reduce the impact of that tree. I think trees in parks where they fall and it hits grass, perfectly fine. I think where it's in an urban setting or next to a house where it could fall on someone, on a car or something like that, we need to have a critical evaluation of that tree.
I had a tree when I purchased my home, it was probably about 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. There was a very large tree in the backyard, and there were large trees on both sides in the other lots. And it was the arborist said, you better take that down. It looked bad. So I, at some expense, took it down. Mm-hmm. But then I was really interested in what happened to the tree on the left side or the east side of my home, because I had a wide open space in the backyard. And now over time, that tree that has a very long limbs that have gone over that, you know, they grew to fill that space.
So trees aren't like humans. They don't have the sensory nerve system that we do, but they do have other ways to understand, oh, I'm getting more resources in this area. Let me grow towards that light. And so we think of trees as singular beings. We can take one tree out of a forest. We don't think of them as groupings, especially in urban settings. But when you remove, and I was actually just talking to the city of Atlanta about this. We were talking about them doing an urban forestry management plan. And one of their big problems is that people in their backyard, similar to you, buy a house. They want to put in a pool or something of that nature. And so they have a tree in the way and they remove one tree, not understanding that this is a grouping of five or six trees. And by removing that one tree, you're compromising the whole. And really thinking about how we think about trees in an urban setting, that a group of 15 trees is one entity working in a symbiotic relationship. And that by removing one, you're compromising the whole. And if you think of it that way, maybe we should be thinking of more creative design solutions than putting the pool right in the center.
Yeah.
And really preserving some of those trees. New Atlanta is a city in a forest, but yet it's still losing urban tree population, urban canopy. There's a reason for this, and this is the reason. You remove one tree, and then 5 years later, five more trees fall. These all have a chain reaction effect that we're not actually thinking about when we remove that one first tree.
Hmm. Galen Williams, our guest, associate professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Galen Williams. Galen is an assistant professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us as we talk a lot about trees and using trees to help cities deal with climate change. And take your calls. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or email totalk@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Mike in Madison, thank you for joining in. What's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Question about permeable pavement and why that's not used so much more in urban development. I happen to work at a place where we did, 20,000 square foot parking lot of permeable in Madison, Wisconsin here, and it hasn't heaved. It has been great. And as your guest knows from working in Texas, the heat off of asphalt issue is incredible. So maybe you guys could cover a little bit on the wonderful use of permeable pavers and things to help reduce global heat as well as our watershed.
Mike, thanks for calling. Galen, comments?
Yeah, that's it reminds me of some of my contractor friends back home. We actually use permeable pavement a lot in the South, in New Orleans and in Texas in the Houston area. I don't see it as much here. I'm curious, and I need to do a little more research, if there's a salt-related issue because of how much salt and snow you have versus the South. But in the South, where water is a big issue, water management, severe storms, hurricanes, groundwater recharge, especially in New Orleans, where we're right on that Mississippi River Delta, a lot of organics in the ground. We really need to keep that soil hydrated. And so permeable pavement has become commonplace. It's actually some of the work we did from my firm in New Orleans actually introduced green infrastructure, including permeable pavement, to this comprehensive zoning ordinance. So now it's required in most, if not all, city-permitted developments.
Hmm. And permeable pavement, some people may not understand exactly what that is.
So there's a couple of different varieties. My favorite is permeable pavers, which allow for a gap between each brick. And you can get it vehicular rated or you can get it pedestrian rated, but it allows water to drain in between the bricks. And there's usually a sub aggregate layer that allows the water to store and then percolate into the groundwater. So it's really increasing groundwater recharge in the spot where the rain falls, instead of channeling it, putting it into the sewer system, pumping it somewhere, or draining it somewhere. It's really allowing that groundwater recharge, which is actually really important for places like Madison that has a lot of lakes and a lot of natural water systems, to get that water in the ground and into the natural system earlier instead of through piping and channeling.
Yeah. Mike, thanks a lot for calling. Excuse me. Jay in Two Rivers, it's your turn. Hi, Jay.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. In 1971, I was a charter member as a college student for the Two Rivers Environmental Advisory Board, which was formed to try to find solutions to our tremendous loss of Dutch elms at that time, because those were the primary trees in our city. And since then, the city has been proactive, offering monetary incentives for homeowners to plant trees. But in spite of the city's efforts, at least a minimum, and probably much more, then 50% properties that change hands invariably have the new homeowners remove very nice trees that are protecting them from the sun and could reduce their air conditioning load in the summer. And this has been going on for decades, that we're just not keeping up because new homeowners take their trees down.
Hmm. Comment on that, Galen.
So some of my work I've done with tree advocacy groups actually touch on this subject. There's a fear of trees. We talked about it a little bit with the first caller, of the idea of this tree falling on my house, this tree being a liability. And I think it all kind of circles back to how we look at trees in the urban environment, that if this tree falls, it's my responsibility. I have to take care of it. I can't afford a lot of things, let alone to repair this tree, or the damage this tree will do, so let's get rid of it. And we're not actually seeing the actual benefits that accumulate or know how to calculate those benefits to see the long-term reason why that tree was there in the first place, or what it was actually doing to benefit my electricity cost, or like quality of life issue of being able to go outside and use my yard space year-round. We also don't think about trees as locations where trees can be planted. We like to see a physical tree, and if that tree's gone, then it's gone, and not that there's a space where a tree should be that's no longer, we're not at our full carrying capacity, if you will, of street trees, that this segment of this block should hold 9 street trees, and if it's at 8, we're only at 90% or whatever the math would be. Those are two things that I'm really curious of, how we can start working with communities to understand that shift in dynamic, that if a tree falls, that like if a phone pole falls or electricity line, we don't feel any responsibility for correcting that. We understand that through our utility bill or through some other mechanism, someone will come out and replace that pole and reestablish the line. So if a tree falls, though it's giving benefits, if not equal or greater benefits, why do we not have the assurance that if this tree falls or if this tree needs to be replaced or moved, that it is a community responsibility and that we are putting in enough money or effort through our taxes or dedicated funds to have that replaced and to manage properly?
Yeah, I guess it's interesting. And his comment about Dutch elm trees, if you were to drive through Madison back then, when Jay is calling from Two Rivers, Madison, many, many streets were lined with elm trees.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you would be driving through a tunnel. It'd feel like you were driving through a tunnel of trees.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all elms.
Elms are historically known for their what we call a pleached allee. They're a vase-shaped tree. And so when you plant them in rows, they will come and touch each other. And like you said, a tunnel. Dutch elm is a disease. It's something to be worried about. The elm tree, the American elm tree, is making a comeback. We've hybridized it too. And a lot of the elms you're seeing planted around here is a hybrid. And also there are identified, especially on the East Coast and in the South, American elm trees that are Dutch elm resistant. So the Princeton elm, the Jeffersonian, those are two elms that have been proven and tested against Dutch elm. And so we're cloning that tree and planting that a lot more as well.
But the concept of planting all one, I mean, you know, what did we replace them with in Madison? Well, ash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So biodiversity is something very real and something to be considered. It's something I think should be very much considered on a regional or city level, understanding what your entire population is. I think on a site-specific level, being a landscape architect, understanding the beauty of having the replicable tree forms and creating architecture with trees. I don't prescribe to necessarily on a block-by-block basis mixing it all up. I do understand patterns and rotation, big tree, little tree, or big, little, and rotating it that way. But I think on an overarching city level, I prescribe to the 30-20-10 rule of not exceeding 10% of one specific species, not exceeding 20% of one genus, and then not exceeding 30% of one family. Could be a little bit hard. We have a lot of oaks. We have a lot of, but it's something to prescribe to really decrease your risk of losing all of your population all at once.
Yeah, it's awful when that happens.
Yeah.
Galen Williams, our guest today, is we're talking about trees and using trees to help cities deal with climate change and talk about what cities can do in addition to trees to mitigate climate change. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Is there, remember, I was reading something that you may have been quoted in, older trees versus young trees, and the value of older trees that we don't get to see as much as maybe we should.
So, yeah. Part of my dissertation research was looking at the value of trees in the landscape. As a landscape architect, understanding why I would plant certain species for certain reasons. Using iTree, it's a kind of an allometric equation modeling system developed by the U.S. Forest Service, peer-reviewed, to understand, based on the lifespan of a tree, putting a tree at 3-inch caliber, early landscape, kind of the minimum size, and extending that or projecting that those benefits over 100 years, which trees are actually doing the best for different ecological services. And so four of the main ones that iTree produced was stormwater management, or three of the main ones, stormwater management, air quality, and carbon sequestration. And I did this back home in Louisiana, but if I knew I was going to plant on a given site 20 trees, understanding the existing urban forestry, I wanted to model what the existing trees were going to do. And so I kind of set my baseline there, and I understood that these are older trees, and while they're doing great on stormwater management, the ability to capture with their big canopies a lot of stormwater, where they fell short was on the carbon sequestration. They have reached their critical mass. They are not putting on a lot of new growth, but they're also kind of on decline. So as much carbon as they might be taking in, they're still releasing a lot as well. And so we saw, as we projected these over 100 years, the existing trees, the bell kind of formed the bell curve. It, you know, went up, or and it was going to go down after kind of like 40 years of growth. So putting in new trees, understanding that there's a give and a take. So some of the old trees are really great for stormwater management and shade and other comfort levels. But in terms of the climate mitigation aspects of carbon sequestration, the youth of a tree and the ability to put on a lot of biomass early on is really what's sucking the carbon out of the air.
Very, very interesting. And the older trees are also providing pretty good space for wildlife, birds and insects.
And so when you start thinking about urban forestry, you really need to start thinking of tree succession, but also just the different age groups. So it's not just as biodiverse in terms of species, but it's also in terms of age. What's your new growth doing? What's your older trees doing? And do you have a good proportion of each one? Because if you have old trees, and we're seeing this in the city of New Orleans, we're known for our famous live oaks that do the same thing, branching over St. Charles Avenue. They're coming up on maturity. They're aging. And with climate change and more heat, and actually a drought we had last year, we had notable, like, it was in the newspaper, a lot of these older trees are falling. They're falling apart. If we lose all those trees all at once, kind of like Dutch elm disease, where are we left? And so are we actually cycling through, replacing some of the trees with the younger trees? And we actually saw this at LSU, where they had this space that was surrounded by live oaks, and they realized after two got struck by lightning, and there was a big, I call it the snaggle tooth of, you know, tree, gap, tree. How do we start putting in the younger trees that will take their place, that we always can sustain this, like, landscape value or this look or these benefits?
Katie in Fond du Lac, it's your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hi there, gentlemen. Great show. I have often wondered, because most cities, the municipalities, own the terraces upon which trees are planted. And because of climate change, I can't understand why these cities don't mandate that a tree must be planted on every terrace.
That's a good question. I just recently found out what terrace meant here in Madison. So we're talking about this area between the curb and the sidewalk, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. I think that's the goal. Mandating is more of probably a legal aspect that it's hard to enforce. I think the city of Madison, from my conversations since I moved here, would love to see every street tree line. I think you need a lot of funding to maintain those trees. And I think a lot of citizen work of monitoring and making sure those trees are well watered. I don't see the funding available, but I think that is the goal to eventually or have all of our street trees planted.
Yeah. I sat on the Dane County Tree Board for 6 years or so, and that was certainly a goal. And I think Madison is a tree city, has reached tree city status. So while it's not mandated, it is encouraged, and you know there are and the city in Madison's case. I mean, we're talking about the whole state here, but in Madison's case, the cost of that, I think, the city takes on.
Yes. So we, in other jurisdictions that I've worked with, this is a dilemma, right? We can barely keep the streets paved, let alone the street trees. And unfortunately, how we look at street trees in our urban environments, it is an aesthetic luxury. It is not deemed a utility. It's not deemed a basic quality of life. It's nicer streets or people that can afford it, more affluent areas, get this tree-lined streets, and that you really have to advocate in order to have it in less underserved communities. We're trying to help with education of why these are beneficial so that people are advocating for their community to get them planted, and also increase the education of what it takes to actually maintain a younger tree to maturity, the pruning, the watering, the when to call in a professional. One of the tools we've once used was like on a neighborhood basis, what's a map of our neighborhood? Where, as a citizen, would you like to see a tree? And maybe that can bring in some citizen ownership of let's plant the tree where people actually want them and get those in the ground first. There's a lot of different tactics. I think it's just a lot when you think of the amount of square miles and a lot of square footage of how many street trees are actually needed and how many communities are underserved.
Katie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Turley in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. I'm a tree advocate in Madison. I'm retired, so I get to spend all my time tree hugging. And I just wanted to make a comment about Madison specifically, that Madison has this gigantic sustainability plan, which has been in place for over 10 years. And there's a lot of tree issues in there to prioritize trees over development. So development has to be set back to allow for street trees and to prioritize pedestrian bicycle traffic and wider terraces to accommodate more trees and not build streets to accommodate cars, encouraging more green lifestyles. But there's no policies in place for most of that. So, for example, on Jennifer Street, which is in my neighborhood, there was a neighborhood effort to underground just the high-voltage distribution lines, power lines, which is the lines that the city no longer wants to plant canopy trees under. The entire project for 13 blocks was going to cost $200,000. That neighborhood is in a TIF district from East Washington, and there was $25 million in the TIF fund. And instead of doing this experimental project to enable canopy trees, they spent all $25 million building a parking structure. That's a parking structure by the Sylvie.
Well, it takes us a little off, but in some ways, off the topic, but in other ways not. Comment, Galen?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the idea of prioritization in the urban landscape and the value we put behind trees. I think of it as a quality of life basic service. And once you establish that, it's just as important as that water line, that drainage line, that fiber optic line. And it's interesting, like, when we think of it that way, because trees were planted in urban areas before there was electricity. before there was gas lanterns. Yet we found ways to make sure every street corner is lit. We have ways to make sure that every house is serviced with water. We have ways to make sure every house is serviced with electricity, that every cell phone has access through these towers. But yet we have not prioritized how we are ensuring that everyone can walk to the store under tree canopy or things of that nature, and the distribution of where trees need to be located in order to maintain that. I think we're shifting. I think more people are aware of climate change, that it's affecting their daily lives. I think everyone that is putting on their air conditioning and the cost of that, that increases this summer. And one of the outlets to helping mitigate and adapt to that is tree planting. So we're getting there. It's just it's a process. When we talked about New Orleans and flooding, we grew up in New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina, very fearful of water. It was get rid of water as quickly as possible, just the remnants of yellow fever and mosquitoes. Through 20 years of working and understanding how we can live with water, design with water, manage water, and what it needs to be in order to be sustainable, we have water management in our CZO. People are asked to hold on to water on site in a manageable way. There's a lot of biology there, but we understand that with the mosquitoes, 57 species that are in New Orleans, that every single one of them needs at least 3 days in order to procreate. And so if we can manage the water, hold it for at least 24 hours, living our existing aged drainage system an opportunity to drain and manage, that we don't have to spend billions upon billions of dollars trying to redo the engineering behind making New Orleans not flood. And so I think there's a will and a way. I think it takes a lot of effort, a lot of research, but we'll get there.
Katie in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Katie.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I am at the present moment sitting under a 60 or 70-year-old black walnut tree that's in my urban backyard. And it is the most beautiful, the filthiest tree I have ever encountered. I can't tell you how many people have told me I should take it down, and I just will never do that because this tree, I mean, it's old. You can feel the age and wisdom in this tree. And instead of turning on my air conditioner on these hot days, I can literally sit in my backyard and in the shade and enjoy the breeze. And it's just been so beneficial in so many ways. I just spent quite a bit of money actually on getting it pruned and the canopy done, and they actually installed a cable on the limb that's headed toward my house so that if it does come down, it doesn't come down on the house. And I do have urban concerns. The branches do go over the garages on both sides of my neighbor's garages, but they don't seem to be concerned about it. And it's just not a tree. I think everybody realizes the benefit of this tree in my backyard.
Yeah, I love that. I love hearing those types of stories. I always, just to get people thinking, think, so what happens if lightning strikes and the tree's gone? And so I always think of, let's think of the next 50 years. Are we planting the tree that's going to replace it now so that if something does happen to that tree, we don't lose everything we are holding on to and love right now? And I think that's kind of that analogy from LSU where they were planting the smaller trees or something to eventually take its place. Trees can live a very long time, but they're not immortal. They do have a life cycle. And so I challenge you a little bit to think, okay, so if I love all of these things and my future generations will live in this house, how do we preserve the quality of this landscape and the benefits that it's producing for our future?
Yeah, interesting. Katie, thank you so much for calling. Galen Williams, our guest today. I'm Larry Mailer. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today. Larry Mailer here with my guest, Galen Williams, an assistant professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. We're talking trees to help cities deal with climate change and some other things as well relating to it. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Aaron emailed that you mentioned, Galen, that cloning a hardier elm, but is that part of the main problem, the cloning? If elms or other species were grown from seed, wouldn't there be a better chance of species survival from diversity within the species also helping reduce costs for cities.
Yeah, to a degree.
I'm glad you brought that up because I'll talk to that a little bit. So one thing that is actually one of my students asked me about clones and reproduction. Clone is a natural process. They once said that the gardens are one of the first mm-hmm. laboratories, and we quickly discovered that plants can propagate by seed, but they also can propagate by cuttings, and that's exactly what a clone is. It's a cutting that we root and basically has the same genetic material as the parent plant. In the urban settings, as a landscape architecture, I value that. I love the consistency. I like to put things in the landscape to design a certain quality, and clones are a way to do that. We also do actually something else when we put those into our landscape. The range of reproduction of a tree that is cloned in the landscape is very extensive. Wind carries the seed everywhere. There's still a lot of natural seed-bearing elms in nature. There's a lot of wild spaces, a lot of parks. We are actually helping introduce some of these genetic resistant qualities into those natural spaces. And so we're basically playing a little chemistry or biology, but by introducing these genetic traits to our urban landscape, we are actually helping promote those genetic traits in the natural landscape as well. And so if you look around, and if you know American elm pretty well, along all the trails, I'm seeing it all the time, we are seeing American elms pop up. You'll see them usually on the edge conditions. You'll see their big, large, asymmetrical leaf. But we're seeing more and more of them. That's because we've probably introduced more genetic material that is resistant, and now they are naturalizing and helping improve the quality of the native elms. And so I always advocate if there's ash or other susceptible trees in park settings where if we do lose it, it's not going to fall on someone or fall on a car, then let's see what happens with that tree and allow it to reproduce and start increasing the genetic material of the region.
Mark and Nina will give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Hello there. Thank you for having a guest on today. I have a question about planting a white-tipped cedar, and I live in Nina, but I'm in the Appleton area, and Appleton area tends to have kind of heavier clay soil, and I'm worried that planting that white-tipped cedar, it might not survive. Do you have any perspective on that?
Unfortunately, I do not. I'm not as familiar with the native ecology on that level up here just yet. I would advocate if you have worry about it, there's some other people you can ask, but also I would plant what you know grows, right? Like,
I'm no expert on cedar either, whether or not it's going to sustain itself in a clay kind of situation. I think it would be difficult, be honest, but you're probably going to need to do some more research on that, Mark, because today we can't help you out, unfortunately. Oh, man. So mature trees, are they more important than younger trees or just part of the mix?
I think it's part of the mix. I think you have to find that balance. I think both are bringing great qualities to your landscape.
What efforts are being made to educate municipalities on the use of trees in managing runoff and so forth?
Gosh, that's a loaded question. I think on the national level, U.S. Forest Service has a whole urban forestry division. Through the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, billions of dollars were dedicated to bringing urban trees to underserved communities. I think the state of Wisconsin was a award recipient on that, and so some of the municipalities. So the funding's there. I think community specific or jurisdiction specific, but I think there's mechanisms out there to help educate and also give resources to increase urban forestry.
If you were designing a new city, how would you design the infrastructure to make it resilient?
I would put all major utilities under hardscape roadways and then leave ample space for tree plantings in the center, what you call like the median, but we call them neutral grounds in Louisiana, the center planting area, and then on both sides of the sidewalk, between the curb and the sidewalk, but also leave public land between the private land and the sidewalk to create that full canopy.
I would also think of urban forestry as I would a utility, or like, let's say water. So reservoirs, where are our big banks of trees? What's our main lines? What's our canals? What's our rivers that are, well, canals is probably more appropriate, but that are bringing fresh water or drainage for cities. So what are our large boulevards? What are our large parks? What are our large reserves? What are our small pocket parks? And really make sure those are fully integrated.
Warren in Verona has something for you, or a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Warren.
Hi. I had a question on the tree genders and whether, and I've heard like some of the original city planners would only plant male or female trees as a way to control trees, but that perhaps that's the pollen has nowhere to go when there's not both genders. And is that increasing the amount of pollen, or is that like urban myth?
That is
a son with allergies.
That is actually urban myth. So the portions of it, there's a lot of trees that have both male and female. So there's a just a finite number that are actually either male or female. And to be fair, there were planted more males than there were females of those populations. Because like Ginkgo biloba is one of them. Its fruit would fall. It smells really bad. We didn't want it in our urban environment. So those were mostly male trees that have been planted. But to say that the pollen has nowhere to go, the other trees are not vacuums sucking in the pollen. The same amount of pollen is going to be produced and fall regardless of if there are female trees nearby or not. That's not affecting that quality, air quality. You could make an argument that there are more pollen, male pollen trees in a city, but as I look around all of our oaks, some of our other species, they are both male and female, so they would produce the same amount of pollen regardless. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thanks. Okay. I remember the discussion on ginkgos from botany 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Thank you, Warren, for calling. Appreciate your call. Cindy says she has a large locust tree located in the terrace area between the sidewalk and street. The homeowner is responsible for maintaining the sidewalk in front of the home, and the roots have caused uneven sidewalk. She'd like to remove the tree to prevent continually having the sidewalk repaired, but her husband is against removing it. What do you think?
That's a loaded question. I'm not getting in between a husband and wife. I think it's something to consider. I think a tree, a mature tree in the sidewalk, the terrace area, is really important. I think it brings great quality to the landscape. I do not advocate for spending every single year or every single 5 years redoing the sidewalk. So then we need to find a mechanism as a landscape architecture to understand what would allow the roots to grow and the sidewalk to maintain itself. Does that mean replacing the sidewalk? And I'm not familiar with what code requires, but does that mean maybe a modular system like pavers that can be repicked up and stacked at a low cost? Does it mean bridging up with a little bit of aggregate layer to allow those pavers to sit above a little bit so that they're not settling or being disrupted by the roots? I think these are critical questions. I think that's kind of the mechanism I would have. What is a more sustainable sidewalk material? But I think a value of having an urban street tree is worth rethinking the sidewalk.
Okay. What are you hoping to see in the next 5 or 10 years when it comes to cities changing their infrastructure?
I would like to see and I think the city of Madison has this. I was talking to the city forester recently, but dedicated funding for urban forestry. I would like to see cohesive efforts between jurisdictions. So in the city of Madison, we have the city. We also have Dane County. We also have federal state land. We also have utility easements and parks. And I would like to see a vision plan, if you will, that really takes all of these jurisdictions and puts them under one umbrella to how we're going to manage this as a cohesive entity. Trees don't know jurisdictional lines. Tree to tree for moths in your jurisdiction, but all the rest are still untreated. And we're not really talking and getting that cohesive effort. Dedicated funding for tree removal and replacement, assessments and modeling to understand the benefits of the trees, establishing the baseline of what the urban forest here right now is doing, and then working to increase that in terms of canopy coverage, but also in terms of climate adaptation and climate mitigation. Biodiversity, decreasing the risk. So understanding we have so much population of trees existing, what species should we be introducing and planting and diversifying, you know, to make sure we're not losing another Dutch elm catastrophe? It's probably another point, but those are the highlights.
Well, maybe we'll get you back, Galen, and we can do this again, and you can come back and talk with us some more about this. Appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was a great conversation. Thank you.
Galen Williams, an assistant professor in the Department of Planning and Landscape Architecture at UW-Madison. We'll try to get him back and we'll talk again with him. Thank you for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort, and our producers, of course, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.